The headlines, Tehran and Moscow both reject allegations of Russia using Iranian drones in the war against Ukraine. Iran's foreign minister says U.S. sanctions are violating human rights by blocking direly needed medical supplies to hundreds of EV patients. And also in our headlines, a general strike in the occupied West Bank to commemorate a young Palestinian who was killed by Israeli forces in a confrontation. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russia is denying Western reports that Iran has been supplying it with drones to use it in the Ukraine war, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine. And I would recommend that you do not underestimate technological capabilities of the Russian drone industry. I can tell you we know what we do and we know how to do it. But I can tell you that, first of all, the press secretary of the president said that they are Russian-made. Secondly, when you see the debris on the ground after they hit the targets, you would see inscriptions in Russian on the shell. So I don't think that Russian is very much widely used in Iran.
Addressing a UN Security Council session, Polyansky said the claims by the Western states are nothing but conspiracy theories. He warned that Moscow would reassess its cooperation with UN Chief Antonio Guterres if the world body carries out an investigation into the origins of the drone. Speaking to reporters in New York, the Iranian UN envoy also dismissed the drone allegations as unsubstantiated and politically motivated. Amir Saeed Yaravani said Iran has all along called for an end to the war in Ukraine and invited the warring sides to exercise self-restraint. He said Iran is opposed to a flare-up of tensions and is urging all parties to respect the UN Charter. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says his country has always stood up against the West propaganda and will never give in to such a campaign. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with hundreds of young Iranian elites and those excelling in scientific fields. He rejected as wrong and unrealistic the notion that the Islamic Republic is on the verge of collapse. Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemies have been engaged in such negative campaigns for the past four decades, but Iran's stability and the continuity of its revolution have proved them wrong. He also referred to the role of universities in thwarting the plots of the arrogant powers. Ayatollah Khamenei was referring to the recent riots that spread to some universities where lecturers and students were pushed not to attend their classes. The riots began following the death of a young woman in hospital days after she collapsed at a police station last month. A forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. Iran's foreign minister says sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. He made this statement during a visit to Iran's EB House, an NGO which supports patients with rare skin disorders. Salman Kujiri reports.
Iran's foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, has paid a visit to EB House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EB Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
Another Palestinian youth losing his life due to Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian health officials say Mohammad Fadi Nouri succumbed to his injuries hours ago. He was only 16 years old. Mohammad had been injured during clashes with occupation forces at the entrance of Al Bira city last month. The health ministry reported at the time that the teenager had been shot in the abdomen. Also happening in the occupied West Bank, Palestinians are on a general strike to pay homage to Uday Tamimi, a young man who was killed in a confrontation with Israeli forces last night. They'd been chasing him for 10 days. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil explains what exactly triggered the violence.
What happened last night is that a Palestinian young man, Uday Tamimi, 22-year-old from the Shafat refugee camp, was killed by the Israeli forces. The story of Uday Tamimi is that 10 days ago, exactly on the 10th of October, Uday Tamimi arrived at the illegal Israeli military checkpoint that was established at the entrance to Shafat refugee camp, the hometown of Uday Tamimi. He left a vehicle, opened fire at Israeli soldiers there, killed an Israeli soldier and wounded three others. Then the manhunt for Uday Tamimi was going on since the 10th of October. All entrances to Shafat refugee camp, Anata town, and Al-Salam neighborhood in Al-Quds were completely sealed. Palestinians were not allowed to leave or enter the Shafat refugee camp. What happened last night is, again, Uday Tamimi arrived at the illegal settlement of Ma'ane Adumim near Al-Quds, near Al-Izariyya town, and he confronted the Israeli forces. The Israeli military declared that they succeeded to shot dead Uday Tamimi after a manhunt that continued for 10 days. Today in the occupied West Bank, a general strike has been declared in Al-Quds and all over the occupied West Bank. All schools had been closed, no businesses. Palestinians are saying this is the least to offer this Palestinian fighter.
Australia has reversed its recognition of West Al-Quds as the capital of Israel, saying its embassy will remain in Tel Aviv. Canberra expressed its regret about the decision made by the previous administration, calling it political. Australia was one of the few countries with an embassy in Al-Quds.
Australia has reversed a decision made 4 years ago to recognize West Al-Quds as the capital of Israel. Canberra stated that the move had undermined peace and put the country out of step with the majority of the international community.
The Australian government remains committed to a two-state solution in which Israel and a future Palestinian state can coexist in peace and security within internationally recognised borders. We will not support an approach that undermines this prospect.
The Australian Foreign Minister also said the status of Al-Quds should be resolved in negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians and not through unilateral decisions.
Today, the government has reaffirmed Australia's previous and long-standing position that Jerusalem is a final status issue. And a final status issue that should be resolved as part of any peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian peoples.
Canberra's announcement angered Israel. Tel Aviv criticised the U-turn by the centre-left Labour government as a hasty decision and summoned the Australian ambassador.
In light of the way this decision was made in Australia as a hasty response to an incorrect report in the media, we can only hope that the Australian government manages other matters more seriously and professionally. Jerusalem is the eternal and united capital of Israel, and nothing will ever change that.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority hailed Australia's move. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki described the turnaround as a correction of a mistake previously made by Canberra. The former Conservative government of Australia took this step on Al-Quds after similar moves by the US and a few other countries in 2018. The decision was widely criticized by pro-Palestinian groups as well as the Labour Party. The party, which was then in opposition, promised to reverse the move if it was elected.
The status of Al-Quds is one of the most sensitive issues at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2018, Australia's Conservative government led by Scott Morrison followed then-US President Donald Trump's lead in naming West Al-Quds as the Israeli capital. The move caused a domestic backlash, but the government pushed ahead with the decision nevertheless. Here's a look into what prompted that decision.
Human rights group Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network has praised the Albanese government for differentiating itself from what it called the dangerous political posturing of the previous government. In 2017, then-US President Donald Trump changed 7 decades of American foreign policy by stating that Al-Quds was the capital of Israel. The US relocated its embassy from Tel Aviv to the city the following year. Several countries, including Australia, then followed Trump's lead. Former Conservative Prime Minister Scott Morrison formally recognized West Al-Quds as Israel's capital in December 2018. However, the Albanese government described Morrison's move as out of step internationally and a cynical play to win a by-election in a Sydney electorate with a large Jewish population.
I would say that Mr. Morrison's decision to play politics, and it was no more than that because, of course, we all know where the embassy remained, resulted in Australia's shifting position. I know that this has caused conflict and distress and concern in parts of the Australian community, and today the government seeks to resolve that.
Israel occupied the west part of Al-Quds during a heavily Western-backed war in 1948. It also occupied the Palestinian territory of the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, in another war in 1967. Ever since, the regime has dotted the territory with hundreds of illegal settlements that have come to house hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent state with East Al-Quds as its capital. The Israeli regime, however, lays claim to the entire city as its so-called capital. However, Israeli sovereignty over Al-Quds has never been recognized internationally.
The Syrian president says unity among Palestinians is the basis of their resistance against the Israeli regime. Bashar al-Assad made the comment in a meeting with Palestinian resistance groups in Damascus. Assad said efforts to wipe out Palestinian aspirations has not been fruitful and will never be. The Syrian president added, "What is happening in the Palestinian territory shows that the new generation continues to adhere to resistance." Assad stressed that resistance is not a point of view but a principle and the basis of a right.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this year's long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
And a report by the U.S. Central Bank says the country's economic prospects are becoming, quote, more pessimistic. The Federal Reserve says economic activity has slowed down and demand is weak due to rising interest rate, high inflation and supply disruptions. The Fed added that recession fears have also spread in several districts. The Federal Reserve has already raised interest rates five times since March to tame inflation and avoid a possible recession. The bank says more interest rates hikes are on the way. U.S. inflation has reached a 40-year high of more than 8%. Households are grappling with soaring cost of living, worsened by supply chain problems and skyrocketing energy prices due to the war in Ukraine. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Nature is a source of life, and any harm on it is considered as a crime against humanity and wildlife. A new report has found that the main drivers of wildlife loss are habitat degradation due to the development and farming, exploitation, pollution, climate change, and disease. So, the world needs to rethink its harmful and wasteful agricultural practices before the global food chain collapsed. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, wild populations of monitored animal species have plummeted nearly 70% in the last 50 years, according to a landmark assessment released recently that highlights devastating losses to nature due to human activity. Featuring data from 32,000 populations of more than 5,000 species of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, WWF, Living Planet Index shows accelerating falls across the globe. In biodiversity-rich regions such as Latin America and the Caribbean, the figure for animal population loss is as high as 94%. Globally, the report found that monitored animal populations had fallen 69% since 1970. Marco Lambertini, Director General of WWF International, said his organization was extremely worried by the new data. It shows a devastating fall in wildlife populations, in particular in tropical regions that are home to some of the most biodiverse landscapes in the world, he said. Mark Wright, Director of Science at WWF, said the figures were truly frightening, particularly for Latin America, he said. Latin America is renowned for its biodiversity, of course. It's really important for lots of other things as well. It's super important for regulating the climate. We estimate currently there is something like 150 to 200 billion tons of carbon wrapped up in the forests of the Amazon. That is equivalent to 550 to 740 billion tons of carbon dioxide, or 10 to 15 times more than annual greenhouse gas emissions at current rates. The index found that freshwater species had declined more than those found in any other habitat, with an 83% population fall since 1970. The report found that the main drivers of wildlife loss are habitat degradation due to development and farming, exploitation, the introduction of invasive species, pollution, climate change, and disease. Lambertini said the world needed to rethink its harmful and wasteful agricultural practices before the global food chain collapsed. Food systems today are responsible for over 80% of deforestation on land. And if you look at the ocean and freshwater, they are also driving a collapse of fishery stocks and populations in those habitats, he said. The report argues that increasing conservation and restoration efforts, producing and consuming food more sustainably and rapidly and deeply decarbonizing all sectors, can alleviate the twin crises of climate change and biodiversity loss. It also calls for governments to properly factor into policymaking the value of services rendered by nature, such as food, medicine, and water supply. Also, Guardian wrote, Earth's wildlife populations have plunged by an average of 69% in just under 50 years, according to a leading scientific assessment as humans continue to clear forests, consume beyond the limits of the planet, and pollute on an industrial scale. From the open ocean to tropical rainforests, the abundance of birds, fish, amphibians, and reptiles is in free fall, declining on average by more than two-thirds between 1970 and 2018, according to the WWF and Zoological Society of London's Biennial Living Planet report. 2 years ago, the figure stood at 68%. 4 years ago, it was at 60%. Many scientists believe we are living through the sixth mass extinction, the largest loss of life on Earth since the time of the dinosaurs, and that it is being driven by humans. The report's 89 authors are urging world leaders to reach an ambitious agreement at COP15 Biodiversity Summit in Canada this December, and to slash carbon emissions to limit global heating to below 1.5 degrees Celsius this decade, to halt the rampant destruction of nature. Guardian added the Living Planet Index combines global analysis of 32,000 populations of 5,230 animal species to measure changes in the abundance of wildlife across continents and taxa, producing a graph akin to a stock index of life on Earth. Latin America and the Caribbean region, including the Amazon, has seen the steepest decline in average wildlife population size, with a 94% drop in 48 years. Tania Steele, chief executive at WWF UK, said, "This report tells us that the worst declines are in Latin America region, home to the world's largest rainforest, the Amazon. Deforestation rates there are accelerating, stripping this unique ecosystem not just of trees, but of the wildlife that depends on them, and of the Amazon's ability to act as one of the greatest allies in the fight against climate change." Africa had the second largest fall at 66%, followed by Asia and the Pacific with 55% and North America at 20%. Europe and Central Asia experienced an 18% fall. The total loss is akin to the human population of Europe, the Americas, Africa, Oceania, and China disappearing, according to the report. Despite the science, the catastrophic projections, the impassioned speeches and promises, the burning forest, submerged countries, record temperatures, and displaced millions, world leaders continue to sit back and watch our world burn in front of our eyes, said Steele. The climate and nature crises, their fates entwined, are not some faraway threat our grandchildren will solve. Land use change is still the most important driver of biodiversity loss across the planet, according to the new report. Mike Barrett, Executive Director of Science and Conservation at WWF UK, said, "At a global level, primarily the declines we are seeing are driven by the loss and fragmentation of habitat, driven by the global agricultural system, and its expansion into intact habitat, converting it to produce food." The researchers underscored the increased difficulty animals are having moving through terrestrial landscape, as they are blocked by infrastructure and farmland. Only 37% of rivers longer than 1,000 kilometers remain free-flowing along their entire length, while just 10% of the world's protected areas on land are connected. Future declines are not inevitable, say the authors, who pinpoint the Himalayas, Southeast Asia, the east coast of Australia, the Albertine Rift, and Eastern Arc Mountains in Eastern Africa, and the Amazon basin among priority areas.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how normalizing ties with Assad could help strengthen the axis of resistance against Israel even further, which includes Iran and resistance groups like Lebanon's Hezbollah, all natural allies of Syria.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this year's long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fran Hughes joins us. He's a journalist, author, and activist who joins us from Belfast. Also joining us, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Marseille.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Elijah Magner, first over to you. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad meeting with Palestinian factions, which included Hamas in Damascus. This is said to be a very big deal. Why is it considered to be that?
Thank you for having me. First of all, it is an initiative by President Assad, who opened his arms to Hamas after the position of Hamas in 2011 against the government in Damascus joining the rebels and the Takfiri, thinking that it was possible to overthrow the regime in Damascus. That was a mistake, but Hamas returned to this mistake, and the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, the Hezbollah secretary general Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, both worked on the restoration of the relationship between Hamas and the Syrian president and government to make sure that what happened was a mistake and that Hamas recognized it, changed its policy, and understand that it was only the axis of the resistance that was helping the Palestinian people and group who are willing to recover their land, disregarding the useless Oslo agreement. This is why we see today Hamas in Damascus, after a heavy initiative that made by the members of the axis of the resistance, because it is no longer the time to look at the differences, but to look at what brings all these members of the axis together. Hamas is an important member of the axis of the resistance. It is returning now to the same axis with strength, particularly after the clashes with the Israelis, the sword of Jerusalem, the support to the Islamic Jihad in Palestine. And we've seen that the position of Hamas has changed radically. And now it is time for Hamas to return to Syria, that is also a very important member of the axis of the resistance, with a direct front with Palestine, because also Syria has another cause to recover the occupied Golan Heights from the Israeli occupiers.
What about the timing of this, Frahis, coming at this point?
I'm sorry, Frahis. Having unity talks between the different resistance groups of Palestine. We're seeing a thawing out of relations between, it appears, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. We recently had the ceasefire in Yemen, which may have broken down, but still offers the chance of a peaceful settlement in Yemen. So what we could be witnessing is the re-recognition of Syria as a sovereign nation, as part of the Arab League, as a bulwark to the Zionist aggression that is the apartheid Israeli state. But having said all that, everyone is obviously going to welcome Hamas back to Damascus, welcome them back into the fold. But I must say, as someone who's been in Syria five times, I actually stayed in Latakia for 15 days on a convoy to Gaza in 2010 before the war on Syria began in 2011. I've always thought that Syria, the Syrian government, the Syrian Arab army, and the Syrian people have been very strong advocates and supporters of the Palestinian right for sovereignty and self-determination. And I feel very strongly that Hamas, when you consider Syria fought in two wars on behalf of the Palestinian cause, Syrian soldiers died and Syrian families were left without a father and without a brother and without sons in both those wars. I think it's really important in my mind that I felt that Hamas actually stuck a knife in the back of the Syrian government and the Syrian people when it left in 2011. And indeed, it was invited into Syria in 1999 when they were asked to leave Jordan. So Syria has always been there for the Palestinians. I am just saddened that Hamas was not there for the Syrian people in their hour of need.
Well, Elijah Magnier, what do you think will now happen when you have Hamas cementing its role within, as you mentioned, the axis of resistance at this point, which will strengthen that, against its arch enemy, Israel? I mean, will this impact the way that each acts against the other, meaning the way that Hamas or the Palestinian factions act against Israel and vice versa?
Well, Hamas has been very active in Palestine in the last few years. And I think this time is very important, the return of Hamas to be operative in Syria, because it means the Syrian people have seen more than 11 years of war. Many of these Syrians are really eager to fight the Israelis because they have developed skills that are needed. And they will join the resistance because they have joined the axis of the resistance, many of them, in Nobel Zahra and other cities in Syria, where they are armed with a stronger ideology, and that can support the Palestinian cause even further, particularly in a time when Iran is rising with its weapon, becoming completely independent and showing deterrence. Hezbollah is showing deterrence against the Israelis and imposing the demarcation line on the maritime border between Israel and Lebanon, and threatening the Israelis of any attack on its members in Syria. So we've seen the axis of the resistance taking complete different turn today by imposing a very strong deterrence against Israel. By having Hamas, this will increase the activity of the Palestinians, will bring all those Palestinians who are living in Damascus that have been offering a shelter to the Palestinians since they were expelled from their villages in 1949. And these Palestinians are looking forward to join also Hamas and to join the forces with all the Palestinian group who are willing to turn their back against all the deals that the Palestinian Authority is signing with Israel and agreeing with Israel, and they have opted the resistance. And now we've seen the new generation in Palestine that is uprising against the Israelis, having a society that is protecting them when everybody was thinking that the new generation will completely forget about the Palestinian cause, proving that it's completely different. So by joining the forces of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and other groups, and the Democratic Palestinian Organization that are willing to continue the fight until they liberate their territory, is something very positive to everybody who is supporting this cause.
Well, Farah Hughes, we have noticed that Syria is coming back into the fold and recently, almost with full force in a sense. I mean, we're looking at what has happened with Hamas, which is formalized now, this rapprochement. We're looking at how Jordan's King Abdullah also has signaled that, along with the United Arab Emirates. Can't forget how they embraced each other when that occurred. And then Bahrain reopening also its embassy, just like the UAE did. Several officials in several Arab states are pressing to actually reinstate Syria back into the Arab League, though that has to actually come about. And then more recently, there's been this talk about Turkey, of which the Turkish president said, you know, the time has to be right, in so many words. Why do you think these shifts have happened when it comes to Syria?
Well, think what people have. A lot of people have done is maybe sat on the sidelines. A lot of the countries that you've mentioned withdrew their embassy staff, withdrew their political support for the government of Syria whenever this war on Syria began. It was portrayed as a rising of the people. That's actually how Hamas envisaged that in 2011. They welcomed the revolution from the people. But with time and with hindsight and with 2020 vision, we can all see that this was, although a lot of people said it at the very beginning, that this was regime change that was being fomented by
Saudi Arabia and America and Israel, and latterly Turkey, because Turkey allowed the majority of the jihadists to move unhindered through Turkey and into Syria. And Turkey at this moment in time is actually occupying a large swathe of Syrian territory along the border. So I think that because the government and the people of Syria have stood strong in the face of this international war that has been waged upon them, that people have seen that the regime is now stronger than it was before. It is firmly embedded in place and has the support of the majority of Syrian people. It also has its comrades from the Republican Guard and from Hezbollah and from Russia. So there are three different organizations and two different countries that are standing shoulder to shoulder with the Syrian people against this Western-backed jihadist insurgency. So I think there's a rapprochement between Turkey and Russia. And, you know, Syria is only, like, I love the people of Syria, but it's only a small piece in the wider jigsaw puzzle that is the geopolitical kind of ramifications in West Asia. So I think as Russia and Turkey grow closer, and perhaps Iran and Turkey might grow closer, then at some stage, I hope that the Turkish authorities and Erdogan will remove Turkish troops and allow the Syrian Arab army to protect the border of Turkey and the border of Syria with its own troops. So, you know, there's a wider context here. There's other things going on in the background. And I think that it's these kind of quiet, peaceful negotiations in the background that may eventually lead to Turkey withdrawing, I hope, and that America will then be forced to leave, and the terrorists in Idlib will be forced to leave too.
Well, the confusing part here, Elijah Magnier, which has been a big question mark, is the fact that you have, for example, the UAE formalizing itself again with Syria, but at the same time, it has also formalized its relationship with Israel. Turkey the same. If it were to go ahead with Syria, at the same time, just recently it actually formalized itself back with Israel, and along with some of the other Arab countries. How would that work? Because you have some conflicting interests there, don't you?
Yes, in a way, yes. But we've seen the many Arab and Gulf states have normalized relationship with Israel. Because first, it was a demand from the Americans. Second, they had already a relationship with Israel under the table. However, the position of Hamas returning to Syria is showing that Syria is a heart of the Arab resistance against Israel. Secondly, is the normalization with Israel is not going to change anything, because the Palestinian realized that all the Arabs have normalized relationship with Israel, dropping completely the Arab cause. So for Syria to deal with these countries who have normalized relationship with Israel, it's a matter of state and business and relationship independently from the Palestinian cause. So one step and one position doesn't eliminate the other. However, the countries like the Emirates, like Qatar, like Bahrain, and also Saudi Arabia, that is flirting with Israel all the time, all these countries will realize that they have to acknowledge the position of Syria, Iran, and Lebanon, and the Palestinian willing to fight against Israel. And they can't keep away from Syria, because they think by having a relationship with Syria, perhaps they can push away Syria further from the axis of the resistance, which is a wishful thinking that is not going to happen because of the war everybody in the Gulf have invested in destroying Syria, that caused more than $400 to $600 billion as a destruction, and that needed to reconstruct the country. And this is something that President Assad and the Syrian population will never forget. However, when it deals with the from state to state and business and the reconstruction of the country, Syria has to make a choice to return to the Arab League, but doesn't mean that it's going to change its firm position in support of the axis of the resistance, of which it is a very strong member.
All right. So you have all this happening, and recently, again, We had another major event that took place for our Hughes, and that was, which was about a week ago, when Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, which included Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups. And they also agreed to actually hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. How important is that? And is it a coincidence that this has happened, and then now we're looking at what has happened with the Palestinian factions, including Hamas, going to Syria?
There's probably just the wider ramifications, again, within the region, that what we hear publicly and what we see with the reconciliation talks in hosted by Algeria, I mean, there are probably lots of other kind of communications between Iran and, say, Hamas, and between Damascus and Iran, and between the different groups that different people support, like the Qataris. So, I mean, there are... domestic, and there are ambassadorial kind of communications that are going on within the region. So it could just be what we're seeing optically and what we're hearing is just a solidification of everything coming together. Now, whether or not these unity talks will actually result in say, combined military operations on the ground will yet to be seen. But unity is strength. And the more people involved in the axis of resistance, the more groups, the more individuals, and the more countries, the stronger the combined response could be to any Israeli aggression. Since 1967, there hasn't really been any country in the Middle East who could stand up to the Israeli firepower, because Israeli firepower is really American and NATO firepower, because they supply the weapons, they supply the aircraft, they supply the helicopters, they supply the munitions. But the strength of Iran and the fact that Syria is still standing on its feet after facing over 100,000 jihadists who had come from possibly outside of the country in order to destroy the government and balkanize Syria. Syria is still standing. Iran is stronger than ever. The axis of resistance is having a palpable effect on the apartheid state of Israel. And if somehow the Palestinian factions can actually truly come together, and, you know, really they would need, through the elections, I hope that Abbas would no longer be in charge of the Palestinian Authority, which many Palestinians and many people outside of Palestine consider a collaborative Quisling organization. They have their cars, and they have the trappings of government, and they have money and homes and power and prestige. But that's all in the shadow of the Israeli government.
Well, at the Algiers meeting, there was a quite a deep statement made, Elijah Magnier, by Ismail Haniyeh, in which he said, quote, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." Do you think that that is an appropriate and applicable thing that he said? Is that truly within some kind of reach when he makes a statement like that?
Hamas has extended its hand to the Palestinian Authority, and not in the meeting in Algeria, but before that, a year or a couple of years or even more, asking for reconciliation and asking for a re-election of Mahmoud Abbas, that has been in power for over 16 years, and asking the Americans and the Israelis to help him to spoil the election whenever they are decided. We have to wait and see if the Palestinian Authority is going to acknowledge the will of all the Palestinian groups and run the elections and allow for a free election among the Palestinian population. Because we already know the answer. Everywhere the Palestinian uprising is saying no to any agreement or security agreement with Israel that the Palestinian Authority is holding on to and collaborating with the Israeli. So when Haniyeh said that this is a historical moment, first of all, it's talking about Algeria, one of the countries that are holding the summit, which is a very good sign that there are other countries than the Gulf countries who are holding the Palestinian. And there is another country like Iran who's supporting the Palestinian cause, which is becoming rare today in the Arab world. Secondly, Haniyeh hopes to see the Palestinian Authority accepting to run a new election and Mahmoud Abbas to be removed from his position, because this is what he has been fighting for many years.
Thank you very much, Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. Fry Hughes, thank you, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tahweh and the team, is goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi. A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahif al-Sajjadiyah for Al-Imam Ali ibn Hussein Zainul Abidin, and to the part where he says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from mukhalafatul huda, rejecting or